This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Welcome, everyone, to Literary Treks, our books and comics podcast here on the network. I'm your host, Matthew Rushing, and with me, as he is always these days, is Dan Gunther. Dan, how is it going for you?
Hi, Matthew. Well, things are going quite well. I'm excited to be here again.
Yeah, our first podcast back after the holidays. Did y'all have a good Christmas up there in the frozen tundra?
Absolutely. It was fairly quiet Christmas, spent it at home with my family, which was nice. And actually, the weather wasn't too bad over Christmas. We've kind of been hit with some crazy weather in the last week or so, but Christmas was nice.
Well, that is always good. And, you know, what I loved is that StarTrek.com gave us this fantastic present right at the beginning of the year. And they gave us the upcoming list of all of the novels that are going to be coming out in 2015, as well as some amazing nonfiction books for Star Trek, which we haven't had a lot of. So, Dan, what do we got?
Well, Matthew, like you said, we've got the main novel releases for every month of 2015, which is really exciting. In January, the January novel is Deep Space Nine, The Missing, which of course just came out a few days ago, right at the end of December.
Can't wait to get into that one.
Oh, it's excellent. I just finished it a couple days ago. Una McCormick, of course, is one of my absolute favorite writers, and I don't think you'll be disappointed. I think you'll enjoy it.
Well, I am waiting until we get closer to our interview with Una to read that fresh, so I'm trying to stay away from all the spoilers and any conversations about that book, because with her, I just don't want to know anything. I want to go in, and I know just the way that she writes and what she does with characters. I'm really excited to see what happens.
Absolutely. So, February, we have the Next Generation novel, Takedown, by John Jackson Miller. John Jackson Miller made his Trek debut last year with the ebook novella, Titan Absent Enemies.
Yeah, that was really good. I really actually enjoyed that. It was so much fun to have John on the show. He'll actually be back to talk Takedown as well. So I'm super excited about this because, as we heard from the blurbs, Picard and Riker going head to head, that's going to be brilliant.
Every fan's dream, pitting two of your favorite characters against one another. I'm really excited to see where this one goes.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Then, of course, we've got the TOS Savage Trade by Tony Daniel that'll be coming out. And in March, you've got Shadow of the Machine, the e-novella by Scott Harrison. So a great month there for Star Trek books. April sees Enterprise's Rise of the Federation and Uncertain Logic by Christopher L. Bennett, which I am very excited to be. Chris, now, did you see this, Dan, on the BBS Trek boards, that Christopher L. Bennett said that he felt like Tower of Babel wasn't his best work?
Yeah, that really surprised me because I really enjoyed that novel. So, you know, kind of hearing that from him makes me really hopeful for Uncertain Logic. Because he said he basically pulled out all the stops for this one. So in Christopher Bennett terms, that's got to be pretty great.
And if Christopher L. Bennett thinks that the Tower of Babel wasn't his best, then gosh, I hate to think of what his best actually is. It's probably going to just blow us away. So I'm hoping that's the case here with Rise of the Federation, Uncertain Logic.
Absolutely, yeah. So May, we have another original series novel, Crisis of Consciousness by Dave Gallanter. Now, have you read his novel from a few years ago, Troublesome Minds?
You know, I'm starting to think back. I don't know if I did or not. I might have to just go look that one up. But was it? Did you enjoy it?
I really liked that novel. I thought it was kind of a hidden gem, kind of a standout TOS novel. I thought it was really excellent. So I'm really looking forward to this one.
Well, and what's great is that right after that, we hit June, and TNG will be back with Armageddon's Arrow by Dayton Ward. He's been talking about this one for a while, so I'm really excited to see this, especially since he said this is really going to be an adventure novel for the TNG crew. And gosh, has it been a long time since they've done any exploring.
Absolutely. You know, it was... How many years ago now did Insurrection come out when Picard said that famous line, "Does anyone remember when we used to be explorers?" And man, that's really kind of held true since then. I'm excited to see this them finally get out there and, you know, do the strange new world, seeking out new life and new civilizations thing for once.
Well, and then what's great is that we get our second Deep Space Nine book of the year with Sacraments of Fire by David R. George III, which... Gosh, I could not be more excited to, especially knowing that he's going to be continuing that storyline he started in Revelations and Dust, and really wanted to see the fruition of that. You know, there's a lot of hints that he dropped, and I'm so glad that the editors decided to really let him play with that. And then for all of those Peter David, New Frontier fans, it's back with the New Frontier Return Number One. It's an e-novella by Peter David. Sounds like, and it looks like, maybe they might be continuing the series in ebook format from now on.
It kind of looks that way. The interesting thing here is there was an announcement that a new trade paperback was going to be coming out of New Frontier. And now it looks like they've kind of changed their minds on that and split it into three e-novellas over the course of July, August, and September. So, looks like we're kind of getting one novel-length story in three e-novellas. So they might have decided that's kind of the way they want to go forward with New Frontier. And if it means we get New Frontier, I'm all for it.
Well, and everybody is going to think I'm crazy, but I've never read any New Frontier books.
You're crazy.
I know. It was just one of those things when New Frontier was super popular, I was in the middle of grad school. I just did not have any time to read. I barely kept up with any Star Trek books at that point, unless it was the summer. And so just trying to squeeze in, you know, a whole almost year's worth of Star Trek books in 2 months was really tough. Mm-hmm. And so I just never got into the series. But it's definitely something, you know, obviously doing this show that I know I'll end up going back to do. So I'm kind of excited because... this will actually be my first entry into New Frontier. So, Dan, you'll have a lot to tell me, I think, when we get there.
Excellent. Well, I'm definitely looking forward to that one.
Well, August sees Seekers, Long Shot by David Mack returning. So excited to be getting more Seekers. And then, of course, as we talked about, you'll get another New Frontier e-novella that month. And then September, which could not come soon enough.
Hear, hear.
The culmination of Kirsten Beyer's trilogy. She started with Protectors. Atonement is going to end that. And so I'm super excited to be having Kirsten back then. Can't wait to talk to her about that. Of course, the last book in that trilogy there for New Frontier will come out as well in e-novella. Titan comes back finally. James Swallow. Gosh, we need more Titan books, and James Wall, I think, is the man to do it. I've
absolutely
loved his, Synthesis is one of my all-time favorite Star Trek books, and just Titan in general. It's incredible. So Sight Unseen will come out then.
Yeah, Titan and James Swallow put together, they're just perfection. I love his Titan novels for sure. And in November, we have the next Seekers novel. This one does not yet have a title. It's by Dayton Ward and Kevin Dillmore. Of course, they've said that Seekers works best. They didn't even want titles with them to begin with. So, you know, I don't think it really matters that we don't have the title yet. And December, we get another original series novel by Greg Cox, one of my favorite authors. And this one's called Child of Two Worlds, which makes me think it's probably going to be about Spock. And I'm pretty excited about that one.
Well, and it was great. You know, he wrapped up the year with that great movie era book that we did, Foul Deeds Will Rise. And I really enjoyed that book. A great cap to the year. So I'm excited to see him wrapping up the year again here in 2015. And then, as previously had been reported on StarTrek.com, they're going to be doing this really fun thing, the autobiography of James T. Kirk, the story of Starfleet's greatest captain. And Star Trek Dressing the Final Frontier will be released. And so I'm really excited about these. Ghost written by David Goodman, and that autobiography of James T. Kirk. I think he actually picked the tagline, though, the story of Starfleet's greatest captain.
Absolutely. I'm really excited about this. I've heard of this kind of idea being thrown about over the years. It's kind of cool to see it actually happening. I'm kind of curious about how much of it will be kind of recapping episodes and movies we've seen, and how much of it will be what I would really be interested in, kind of filling in the blanks of Kirk's life and childhood and growing up and his personal thoughts and experiences.
Well, David Goodman did Federation First 150 Years, and I think the way that he tied all those things together without just rehashing, you know, the stories we already knew, I thought was great. So I think it's in great hands, this book. And then, you know, I can't think of a better person to put on front of Dressing the Final Frontier other than Jerry Ryan as Seven of Nine. The cover alone makes me want to buy the book, but I think that this would be a really interesting book, especially for all those cosplayers out there who like to make their own costumes, kind of getting an in-depth look at the look and design of Star Trek from a costume perspective. So I'm really excited for this to come out. I think it's going to be a beautiful book.
For sure.
And yeah, they do such a great job with these kind of things. And it's just nice to see some more nonfiction coming out with the Star Trek line. So
yeah, behind the scenes stuff is always a lot of fun, and I'd really like to see that sort of thing ramp up again. You know, in the past we've gotten a lot of like inside behind the scenes books of Star Trek, and it's kind of slowed down a little bit over the last few years. It's good to see more of these coming out.
Well, what's really exciting is that over the holidays, we got a lot of surprises, and we've got a great surprise for you today because it's time to judge some books by their covers, and we've got three of them today, so we're going to be judging books by the covers. We got three today. Hope you come back for more. I don't know where I'm going with that. Jeez.
To a very good place, Matthew, to a very good place.
Well, exciting that we have this many covers to talk about. And Shadow of the Machine, the e-novella by Scott Harrison, they released that cover. And that, of course, that book takes place straight after the motion picture. And what do you think, Dan?
I actually really like this cover. I think the use of the of V'ger from the director's edition of the motion picture in the center looks really, really cool. You know, Kirk with his admiral's uniform looking all commanding. I'm looking forward to this one. It looks very interesting.
You know, I have to say, you know, on a whole, the ebook covers tend to be, they seem to be slapped together very quickly a lot of times. And I can tell all of the things that they have used for this. And yet the compositing here, I think, is good. And I think it's a very compelling cover. The look they have that you know Shatner has on his face as Kirk there, like you said, the director's version of V'ger. This is sufficiently exciting to me, and mainly just because I enjoy this era. Ex Machina is one of my favorite books by Christopher L. Bennett, and I love that era of the right after the motion picture. In that 5-year mission time period, I don't know why we don't have more stories in that era, because it's just, you know, you front load all of these books with TOS era 5-year mission. Well, this is a whole nother 5-year mission that we really just don't know all that much about. So I think this is a great time for authors to be giving us more books.
I agree. And that's one of the joys of these ebooks that have been coming out kind of the opportunity to explore different parts of the Star Trek universe that we don't get to visit all that often. And that's one in particular, like you said, that I think could really use some fleshing out.
Well, the next cover we have is Savage Trade by Tony Daniel. We've got a nice look of an Archer class vessel that is not part of the Seekers line. Although I did hear that David Mack said he wishes they had asked him, because the naming of this vessel, it's like the USS Montana on the cover. And he said that doesn't really kind of jive with where he would have gone with it, because he normally has it kind of have an archery theme to them. And so something like that. So he would have liked to have seen them do that. But I just like that we've got another one of these ships on the cover with the Enterprise surrounded by some aliens.
Mm-hmm. I kind of liked some of the speculation that happened on the Trek BBS. Maybe there's a famous archer between now and then who has the name Montana. Or maybe, you know, Hannah Montana becomes really well known for archery later in her life.
Possibly. Or Joe Montana becomes the world's greatest archer. So that's just my speculation there. So
I'm pretty sure that's actually what happened.
Yeah,
that's really in my is. Personal canon now.
Well, I like this cover. I think it is, again, it's sufficiently exciting. It does a great job of just kind of setting some tension here. And it's always nice to see a different Starfleet vessel involved in something with the Enterprise and kind of seeing the fleet work together, because we just don't get that a ton. So I'm hoping we get some really great storytelling ideas here. And then our very last cover just got released, and it is for Christopher L. Bennett's Uncertain Logic. Dan, man, this, what do you think?
I think this is a beautiful cover. We've got the Kirshara Surux original writings with the planet Vulcan behind it, creating a sort of Vulcan-itic symbol. Very stylized, very different from the covers we've been getting lately, which have tended to be ship shots or the traditional, you know, a couple of characters on the cover. This one's very different, and I kind of like it. I think it's kind of a neat design and generally looks pretty cool to my eye.
I think it's going to be great, because I'm just excited to see us go back to Vulcan and really dig into the Vulcans again. And, of course, like you said, this really referencing a lot of things, the planet itself, the awakening with the Kashyyyk, the awakening with the Kirshara, and then, of course, the fact that it looks like the Itik symbol. All of those things working together, and Christopher L. Bennett actually said that this was one of the only times that he's really given a lot of feedback of what he wanted the cover to be. So I'm glad to see that they listened to him, and I think it's a really interesting cover. So,
right on.
Well, the last thing that we just wanted to remind you is that the Star Trek Planet of the Apes crossover is out. Dan and I will be talking about that a little bit more in depth next week, but we just wanted to make sure that you are aware of that so you could come prepared next week when you listen. And we'll be excited to kind of jump into that and a couple of other comic issues that we have got a chance to talk about yet because of the holidays and all. Before we head into our feature with Drew Stewart from Standard Orbit, we'd like to remind you that Audible is the premier source for audiobooks, with more than 150,000 titles to choose from and new titles coming each week. We've got all those classics, current bestsellers, and of course some of the most famous Star Trek books out there, like Federation, Prime Directive, Spock's World. Audible has something for everyone. And as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice with a 30-day trial just to see how great Audible is. So give that a try today. Catch up on all of those classic Star Trek books you've always wanted to read, or that latest novel. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we'd like to thank Audible for supporting Literary Treks and Trek FM. Well, Harlan Ellison's original version for the most famous TOS episode finally has come to comics. And following in the footsteps of The Star Wars, which was based on the original script for the movie that Lucas had written and set out, and obviously changed dramatically by the time it got to the screen, This time, Ellison's story finally sees the light of day. And we've got a great friend from Standard Orbit joining us tonight, Dan. Drew Stewart, welcome to Literary Treks.
Joy to you, friends.
Welcome.
It's so good to have you here. In fact, Drew, is this your first time on Literary Treks, or we had you
oh,
before?
Oh, heavens no. I've been on a couple episodes already.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. What other episodes did we end up having you on?
Well, I remember one time we talked about a comic where Kirk and them went back to Vol and found
oh,
out that
yes.
they did need a
that
god
a,
after all.
That's right. Yeah, that was really fun. I felt bad because a little bit like Tristan, you know, we'd had him on for those terrible, you know, Voyager comics, and we had you on it, and it was for some really terrible TOS comics, and so...
And then you had me back on for that Harriman book, Serpents
Among
the
right.
Ruins.
That's right, yeah, and that actually turned out to be really good, so we're 50-50.
So, this is the first episode, I think, that isn't about something with serpent in the title.
There we go. Nice. Well, we've got a 50-50 record with you, and so it should be interesting to see how this fares. We've got something kind of newish, and before we get into that, we're just going to give you a blanket warning, spoilers. We are going to talk through all five issues of this comic series. Now that it's finally been released, it's out, it's in trade paperback. If you don't have it, I think it's definitely worth picking up and taking a look at. And so we're going to walk through this storyline as we look through the changes. And we'll talk about the differences later, but we wanted to be able to deal with the story here as it is and then kind of talk through some of those things. So we're all here for it. This issue starts out a little bit differently. You know, we've got a drug deal going down on the Enterprise. Not really something I'm used to seeing, you know, a murder caused by a drug capitalist.
Yeah.
On the Enterprise. What about you guys?
Definitely a little different. It was not the TOS that we're used to, kind of the more sanitized universe that shows up later. Definitely a little jarring to begin with.
Yeah. You can see what Ellison's trying to do. He's trying to poke holes in this, you know, this perfect society, whatever. Everybody's an asshole forever in the future.
If that could be the title of the show, Drew. What I love here is that the drugs look like diamond gummies.
Oh yeah. The jewels of sound. Let's not undersell them. They're the jewels of sound, and I forget exactly in the original script, like you miss the descriptions in the comic, but like in the script, it's just like, man, and you know, the guy takes it and it's like tripping out, totally weird, and it's way too detailed for it just to be a fake drug for Harlan.
Well, what would you rather take, the jewels of sound or methamphetamine? I mean, you know, much cooler.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you name it ecstasy because it sounds like something you want to take. The jewels of sound. Ooh, I want to be swimming in the jewels of sound. That sounds awesome, you know. It turns out, too, that this guy is not only a drug lord on the Enterprise, but he's also basically a drug lord throughout the galaxy because he's been hopping the planets with the Enterprise and getting the indigenous populations kind of used to this drug and giving them a little taste so they just keep wanting more and setting up basically a drug empire. So it sounds like almost an Orion plot, but it's not. It's just a crazy Starfleet officer, drug capitalist.
Under Kirk and Spock's nose, and they had no idea. I mean, these are parts of the problems that I have with it, is just the things that Harlan thinks that people would be able to get away with. Or, you know, just the characterizations are kind of iffy for me.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of them, that no one would notice that there's just this guy, he's been going down by himself on planets and dealing them drugs and then contacting other ships to keep bringing the supply, and you'd think somebody would notice. And is he doing it for money? There's no money in the future.
It's very much reminiscent of New BSG. Like, mm-hmm. everything in this feels much more like that new BSG feel. Even the characterizations of Kirk and Spock, they're a little bit less, I guess you would say, perfect.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more flaws and undercurrent of emotion, even in Spock. And so this all really comes out. And that's really kind of in every single character. There are flaws here, which I think is very interesting because, Drew, I think you might agree. When you watch through the original series now, we can see the flaws in these characters. Mm-hmm. I mean, there really are there, as opposed to, say, when you watch an episode of TNG where the characters seem like, you know, gods among men. You know, they're as angelic as you can get most of the time. And this, though, feels even more realistic and kind of gritty, underbelly feeling to it, which, you know, you come to expect from kind of a Harlan Ellison script.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to see, as we talk through this, and we'll talk through the differences, some of the ways that they took the nuts and bolts of it and brought it out to and made it more, I guess, that Roddenberry Star Trek.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to say it a few times, but this is a good story. It's just not a good Star Trek story. And I think that the changes that they made to the episode make it a good Star Trek story. And as it stands, especially in the even in the comic version, it's just not all there for me.
Mm. It's kind of a alternate what if kind
right,
of thing.
Sure.
But
yeah, it almost seems like an alternate universe episode.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like
not quite the mirror universe, but
yeah,
not
almost
quite
like
ours either.
Well, not necessarily alternate universe in the Star Trek mirror universe, but alternate universe, our universe. Like mm-hmm. this
yes,
is what Star
yep,
Trek
yep.
could have been,
right?
If this had been like the second episode, but mm-hmm. the fact that Harlan kept putting it off, and it aired like 29th, then, you know, he had to make some compromises in order to get with the characters that they'd already established at that point.
So he takes the drug, and we end up with this amazing, like, artistic, tripped out scene of the guy kind of experience the joy of this drug, you know, and he's definitely feeling the music here. And then he reports to the bridge because apparently he's the helm officer. He's sitting in Sulu's seat, and Spock kind of notices that he is about to blow the entire drive because he's going, I guess, so fast, or maybe just braking really hard in space.
No, he's got the emergency brake on, and he's the ship still goes with the emergency brake on, which I'll never understand how why cars do that, let alone starships. So he's like, yeah, he's burning out the emergency brake.
Yeah, damp that starboard unit. Yeah, I don't know quite what that means. I don't know what he's doing, but
I don't think Harlan knows what it means either. Damp the thing, hoist the mainsail.
Spock just seems so nonchalant about this guy acting really strange, sends him off the bridge, and so he goes walking around, and he goes back to Bentwith's cabin, that's the drug dealer, and says, I'm going to turn you in to Kirk and Spock. And so Bentwith proceeds to beat him senseless and kill him on the Enterprise.
In the hallway.
Yeah, not just inside, you know, his room, but in the hallway.
With people like 20 feet away.
Yeah, just watching. Yeah. It's like a common occurrence in this Enterprise. Runs to the transporter room, gets on the transporter, and beams down to this planet. Now, one thing we didn't mention at the beginning is that they have been in this area of space where their chronometers seem to be running backwards and time seems to be acting very strangely. And so when he beams down to this planet, he beams down to the source of this vortex of energy. And so Kirk, of course, hearing what's happened, runs down to the transporter room, gets his boarding party and landing party, and they go down to the planet in search of this guy.
You skipped over Janice grabbing a phaser rifle and blasting through the transporter room doors.
Which was awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, can we talk about how awesome Janice Rand is in this comic?
Now, I didn't get to do it. I was going to make a pros and a cons list, and the pro list was going to be so much Janice Rand.
I would agree with that for sure.
And that would have been like the only pro. But I like the pro. Idea. I miss Rand and having her, just seeing her in this story makes me feel better.
It's, yeah, I think she busts down the door with a phaser rifle, which we never saw enough of those in Star Trek. I mean, I can't, it's like maybe one or two times we ever really see them. It's sad. So they're walking along this planet and they come up to this amazing source of the radiation, which is, as Kirk says, a city on the edge of forever.
And that's my other pro.
It looks like, yeah, an actual it city. Looks amazing. Yeah, it looks incredible. I mean, it looks like something out of a sci-fi, basically Lord of the Rings. Like if you were to sci-fi Lord of the Rings, that's what this looks like. It looks that cool.
It is very Lord of the Ringy. I mean, and then when you get to the Guardians, they look very, you know, the kings of the old kings, the ghost kings.
Yeah, they definitely kind of look like, especially the Nazgul in the latest Hobbit movie. If anybody's seen the latest Hobbit movie, this is kind of what they look like in that film. And yeah, so they end up talking to the Guardians and they tell them, you know, how they guard this, basically this vortex of time, and time doesn't run on their planet. So they don't even know how long they've been here. Time really has no meaning here. They show them how the vortex works, which is that, you know, they can be shown any time and they could go through to that time. And so for some reason, Kirk's like, well, so could we go back to the 30s?
Right.
Like, why, of all the time and space, Kirk, that's what you want to see?
The Great Depression sounds like a happening time. Let's go there.
Yeah. Can't wait to visit Prohibition, USA. We all know how that would go over well with Kirk.
I like that they skipped over dinosaurs and pirate ships. You think Kirk would be one of those. Wait, I want to ride one of those dinosaurs. Can you send us back there?
Oh, that would be awesome. And in fact, Dan and I, we just recently read the new book from Christopher L. Bennett,
The Collectors,
Department of Temporal Investigations. Yeah, and there was a very awesome dinosaur scene in that book. So we're not going to ruin it for you if you haven't read the book, but just check it out.
It's pretty incredible.
So Kirk realizes that they can hold open a certain point in time, that they can go through. And unbeknownst to them, Bentwith is kind of behind them and streaks out, basically. He grabs Rand. She elbows him in the face. Again, Rand just kicking ass. I mean, just awesome. And he makes for the portal and runs through, and he's gone. And that's the end of the first issue. And so, bump, 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 what will happen next? So... it's a good setup. Like I feel like the first issue really kind of gets you into the story, and you know, it's, I think this is the part that's probably the most different from the episode, because the setup is so different from the original, what we've seen on TV so often. And I think that really gets you kind of pumped and jazzed to think, okay, now I want to get to the next issue, because this is not my daddy Star Trek.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. The like you said, this setup is kind of the most different. You know, instead of McCoy, it's this drug dealer guy and the Guardians, and we actually have a city on the edge of forever, which, you know, kind of finally makes the title make sense to me.
Yeah.
When I was a little kid, I was, where's the city? I don't get it, but...
Do you think... Oh gosh, I guess we're just getting into the differences, but do you think that when they got to the production of the episode and they created the Guardian and the Edge of Forever, they just couldn't afford to do even just a model of the cityscape, and so that's why they just had it, you know, be
ruins.
Completely ruinous. Yeah, and
that makes the most sense, I'd say, probably.
No, that's 100% what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is too bad, because, again, I'm thinking, oh gosh, the way the city looks in the comic and they could have imagined, it almost makes me wonder what a remastered episode would look like with an actual city where the Guardian is in the middle.
Yeah.
I think that would be, you know, that's one of those things I'm like, ooh, can Micah Kuda, can they go back and just give us that alternate episode, where they have digitally altered that. I think they're just really cool.
I think we asked Rossi about that when we had him on Standard Orbit. And I think he said they thought about it, but they didn't have the money either. So it's like they're fixing things that they didn't have money for in the 60s, and they still don't have enough money to do what really needs to be done.
Well, that is a lot of work. I mean, creating a whole CGI city and making it work.
Oh, but they expanded the castle in Cat's Paw.
Yeah, that's true. And and in the Cloud Miner city, you know, they redid that.
Yeah, but that's
too,
at least worth something.
Yeah, that's true. So we get to the second issue here, and I thought that just I really liked the explanation of the way that time works on this planet and why, you know, Kirk hasn't been affected and why they haven't been affected. And it works a little bit like the episode, and yet it seems even more plausible because of the way they've set up the story here, the way Ellison has this whole city and this whole planet with this massive, you know, confluence of time running through it. It's almost like we're looking into the heart of the TARDIS. Like that's what this planet is the heart of the TARDIS. And so they decide they're going to beam back up to the ship. Mm-hmm. And when they arrive at the ship, there's a little surprise waiting for them.
Yar, pirates.
Welcome to the Condor.
So I thought this was a pretty cool idea. I can kind of understand why they cut it out, because it's much simpler to just kind of do the Enterprise isn't up there. Oh my God, what happened? But I kind of like this idea. I think it was neat.
It's a good idea to like it, because it gives Kirk and Spock, like, they keep are worrying in the past. Even in the past, they're just like, man, I hope Rand's okay. Mm-hmm. As if they're not hundreds of years in the past, and they can live 100 years in the past and Rand still will not have, like, the door will not have opened because it's the past. Mm-hmm. So it's like they're trying to introduce something that will drive the story and give it a sense of urgency, but there's no point because it's not like they're conjoining in real time, especially because Kirk and Spock spend like a month in the past.
Mm-hmm.
It's pointless to have it be like, let's flash back to Rand. No, it's been a month. Rand is dead. If we're going by that logic,
right? And the temporal mechanics of it is that once they fix time, you know, the river will reorient itself and time will flow back the way it should be. And so you're right, Drew. This is a completely kind of senseless part of the story because it doesn't make sense.
But you do get a good fight scene, and you get more
exactly,
Rand elbowing people in the face.
Yeah. That is true, which actually happens here. They drive them out of the transporter room, these pirates, these brigands, because they're basically just renegades on a ship that looks a little bit like the Enterprise, at the same time kind of looks like you might expect basically an Orion ship to look like as well at this time period. They get all the pirates out, and Kirk and Spock realize they have to go back and change the future. You know, they have to go back to the future. Back to the future.
We have to go back!
We have to go back! Yeah. It's not you, Marty. It's your kids!
Something's got to be done about your kids. Oh, right. Wrong
and,
universe.
He leaves Rand, like you said, Drew, in charge of holding the door for the transporter, which, again, why? Why wouldn't he just leave them on the planet?
Right.
Why are they having to
hold
the door?
I think it's just the, you know, we had to patch the transporter because I blew it up and, you know, can't beam everybody back. And I don't know.
There's that, and I think the other issue might be, and this might be the only thing, and it's not explained in the comic, but it could just be that Kirk is thinking, if we beam down, we all beam down, they're just going to beam down after us.
Yeah.
And I can't take everyone with me through the portal because then we're definitely
going to
change something.
And then heaven knows where
something.
They're going to jump.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's the impetus for this, but then the way they use it later on it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
They should have just explained, you have to stay here because it's going to be the safest place, really. And therefore, we'll go, and hopefully, just being Spock and I, we won't erase the future again.
Mm.
Ah, temporal mechanics gives me a headache. Best Janeway line, so...
What was the pirate ship doing in orbit of the time planet anyway?
Dan, that is a great question. There are no answers to that question, nope. So let's move on. So Kirk and Spock have this great conversation with these guardians. Again, I think this is it's great artwork. It just looks really good here. And I think one of the things that I noticed all throughout the characterizations, especially of Shatner and Nimoy, pretty much spot on.
Mm-hmm.
I think on a whole they look like the character. It almost looks like an Alex Ross kind of style of artwork where it's that photo paint.
Yeah.
Where mm-hmm. yeah, and some of the scenes it literally just looks like Shatner standing there. And
my issue with it is that I guess because I'm so familiar with TOS, I recognize the screenshots that he's tracing, and every time Spock is surprised, it's the moment where the pancake creature clings to his back, and it's used like That's four true. Times in this series. Like every time Spock acts surprised, he's just got that expression of being hit in the back by a pancake, rubber vomit monster. It's
Yeah, there are a lot of times where I notice like the particular framing or how someone's face looks, I can tell exactly what episode that's from. So I did notice that time to time
as well.
So
I'm not alone.
Sure. No, definitely not.
Well, Kirk and Spock, they talk to the Guardians. Mm-hmm. They realize they can go back. They have to be very careful because the littlest thing, and especially not knowing what they call a fixed point in time. Hello, stealing from Doctor Who at this point. if you mess with a person or a thing mm-hmm. that should either be dead or alive, at that point you will irreparably change history, and they can't mess with that. And then they get this nice little poem given to them by the Guardians that they don't understand what it means, talking about blue and the sky and old earth and a sun and
it's so better than the original draft. Like Dan, you said were you going to read the original drafts, or you have read?
I have not read any.
Okay, so in the or like one of the first drafts, because this is like the final draft of Harlan's version of it, but like in the original draft, the Guardians flat out say, "Hey, focal point is named Edith Keeler, and she totally has to die. So you've got to let her die. So if you find her, don't save her life." And Kirk's just like, "I'm going to ignore that," and then runs away. It's like, wait, no. So at least this is better. But I like the idea of like, don't drop clues. Because then the Guardians know what's up. And then you're just like, just tell him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and it makes it almost, it makes it better when they have to figure it out, by themselves. And two, visually, you can't be given those clues as the reader, especially the comic.
Mm-hmm.
It comes off just as, it's too much telling, just show, especially in a comic. Most of the times you needed to show something happening because it's a visual medium anyway, and it's better to do it than kind of already setting up the story, especially one we already know how it ends. Mm-hmm. It's not that much different than the TV episode. So what I really love, though, is that Kirk and Spock run through a nice rainbow, bright rainbow to go through
the
time.
They jump into
portal.
The motion that's picture really poster cute. Is what it is.
Exactly. Yeah, it's really sweet. I'm sad they weren't like holding hands and My Little Pony showed up as well. So that would have been great. Well, of course, they end back at the Depression era. 1930s, most likely New York type city here. All of these guys standing in line for the bread line. And of course, Kirk and Spock arrive not so inconspiciously at this point.
Conspicuous is not part of the part of Kirk and Spock's word. It's definitely just not in their dictionary in this version.
No. So they're standing there, and this guy starts like ranting about how this country is horrible, and it's, you know, run by all of these foreigners and these aliens, and now men like them are having to stand in bread lines, and they pick, of course, Kirk and Spock out
because they're wearing,
because they definitely look like foreigners.
It's confusing.
In pajamas.
Hey, wait a minute! It's not Next Generation yet.
That's true. Although, you know, I have a nice pair of TOS pajamas. They're pretty comfy, so and they look just like that. But they, of course, they end up getting chased, very much like the episode. And then I didn't get this part. They end up in a fight, and then Kirk phasers the lamppost and
disintegrates a
lamppost.
Does that
scares everybody enough?
Yes. Yeah. They're still chasing them, though. It's like, what? Yeah. It's like they forgot about... Well, I mean, Harlan didn't know about the Prime Directive because he only watched Where No Man Has Gone Before and then wrote this. So it's like there's no sort of Prime Directive or worry about, you know, changing the past because they're just running mm-hmm. and shooting. And it's like, what? Do you guys not understand what you're supposed to be doing back here?
Yeah, because they're there to correct something that has changed the past. So you'd think they'd be a little worried about that.
Yeah, the whole...
if we stop the one thing and then start 50 other things that screw up the future, too...
Over on Standard Orbit, we did a commentary on Mirror Mirror a couple of weeks ago, and I called the episode The Butterfly Effect, because I kept bringing it up, that, you know, every little change is supposed to make something different, and the Guardians warn them about this, and how time is a river, and you can't throw rocks in it, you'll divert it. And then Kirk Spock are just running around, just like, it'll change past all over the place. It's like, shouldn't you, like, not?
That lamppost was a fixed point in
time. Exactly.
You know, on that lamppost in 20 years, somebody was going to hang, you know, some kind of banner that someone was going to see and be inspired by, or like a concert poster. And then that person doesn't go to that concert and doesn't meet, you know, Kirk's great great grandparents don't meet. And then we're out of luck.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he starts disappearing in the picture in his pocket. It's terrible. Oh, goodness.
He's got to play at that concert where his grandparents meet.
Exactly. So his parents will meet.
He's got to play Johnny Be Good. They, I mean... Yeah.
Exactly.
But your kids are going to love it.
Yeah, they really will. Well, they run away, and the issue ends with them finding their way into this basement. And that's
a thrilling
where it
conclusion.
Lead us... thrilling conclusion. Spock, quick, to the basement.
But what if the mob follows?
Apparently they're not as athletic, you know, because like Kirk and Spock had jumped over a fence and everything and like run through some laundry lines, so they lost.
Not to mention disintegrating a lamppost, but you know, that's no biggie.
I guess you just don't follow those guys. You know,
well, they can vaporize
that lamppost was there and now it's gone. Don't follow them.
That would be my takeaway.
One of the most interesting things is the beginning of issue 3, where it starts out with a great conversation between Kirk and Spock, I thought. And just Spock talking about this, you know, this is a very barbarian world, and Kirk's kind of defending it. Well, you know, they're hungry and they're tired, and they have this whole conversation about some things that are quite different from what we know, and that this idea of, you know, Spock saying that, you know, his planet was never like this, you know, for thousands of years, and they went into space, you know, in peace. And Kirk's like, well, I guess that's why we hit space 200 years.
No, why the Vulcans hit space 200 years after Earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So some very interesting things here that are quite different from what we obviously know of you know, the original series and how things turned out.
Right.
And so I thought that was interesting. Apparently Vulcans never had any kind of awakening. They were always these peaceful, kind of serene people. And they also made it to space 200 years after humans, when humans basically showed up on their doorstep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So first contact was a little bit different. You know, Zefram Cochrane landed on Vulcan and handed them a CD, basically, of Ooby Dooby and some whiskey.
Wheeled out a jukebox. So. And...
Exactly.
I brought the jukebox.
You guys like dance?
I didn't think you had one.
Hope you guys like it.
Now that's not my big problem with this discussion. I don't like the characterization of Kirk and Spock in this script, which is why they changed it. But Spock keeps bringing up the savageness of these oppressed people in the 30s. Like, these people aren't welcoming us as gods or something. I don't know what he expects. Mm. But it's like these people are afraid and scared. This is, you know, a really crappy part of history. And Kirk's just, or Spock's like, oh, you know, try to tell me Earthmen uplisted my race. Tell me that and use Beckwith as an example of nobility. It's like he's being a complete jerk and talking bad to Kirk.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, he does apologize for it, but it's just neither of them act right.
It seems a little bit out of character. I was kind of okay with the scene, and I really liked it up until I think Spock said something like, "See if you can locate a ring to go through my nose," and I was like, "Oh, okay, Spock, whoa."
Well, and what I think that was interesting here is that the play on that Spock is very alien in this, you know, like his reaction to human beings and that difference is especially from the difference from the humans that he knows in the future, you know, like Kirk and, you know, everybody else on the Enterprise, I thought was kind of interesting and honestly probably a little bit more, should we say, realistic than how it is in the, you know, the original series, you know, that there's some kind of tension, you know. Kirk and Spock always have, and especially Spock and McCoy always have that tension between basically whose race is better, you know. Mm-hmm. But I thought that was interesting that because McCoy's not in this story at all, that tension is playing out a little bit here between Kirk and Spock. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Drew, you were saying that Spock definitely seems almost coming off as like just a complete a-hole to Kirk, but at the same time it was interesting because they are almost equals in this scene having this conversation back and forth. I thought that was kind of an interesting play on their relationship, so it is different. And like Dan, I kind of bristled at the end of it because I felt like Spock was being too much of a D-bag because he had gone too far, basically. Yeah. I think he had just pushed it too far.
It was just...
But before that, yeah, I thought it was a great conversation. Yeah. And an interesting take this early in TOS of what these characters might have been more like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I'm right there with you. And like you say, it just gets kind of pushed a little bit too far and into an uncomfortable zone, which is probably what Harlan was going for. And that's kind of his take on things versus the Roddenberry take on things.
Well, and the coolest part, too, is that I like that Kirk is kind of vindicated with what he's been saying when the guy finds them. It's not Edith who finds them here. This guy finds them in his basement and basically offers them a job around this apartment building that they've broken into, saying, "Hey, I've got work that I need done, and you guys feel free to stay here. I just need help doing the work around here, and I'll give you a job."
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a time when people are begging for jobs, you know, Kirk and Spock basically rely on the kindness of strangers. They're like Blanche DuBois at this point, which I think is great because, you know, Kirk gets to turn to Spock at that point and say, "Worse than barbarians? You know, like, maybe you've judged a little bit too harshly there, Mr. Spock."
Which mm-hmm. Spock should know better, which...
Yeah, and I think that's one of those things, Drew. Like you said, Harlan's only read the first episode of TOS, so he doesn't understand these characters really where they come to. And it sounds like in some ways he really didn't talk to anybody after that,
nope.
My guess, because he doesn't understand where they're trying to go with these characters. So this is just, like, as we talked about before, kind of that more gritty, realistic nature of the characters we meet in maybe the very first episode of Where No Man has Gone Before. And it's interesting, at least I think it's interesting enough to see it and make me wish that maybe some of these things might have played out a little bit more. And I definitely see this kind of thing. I wish we had seen more in TNG. Mm-hmm. You know what? Mm-hmm. I really think that show could have been something that would stand the test of time because of that. Whereas I look to DS9 for that now instead of TNG, because it that perfectionism is just grating after a while. To me, that's my personality. So I'm not speaking for everyone, because you know there are those who just, you know, TNG is their favorite, and that's what I love about Star Trek. It's got something for all of us. So. Mm-hmm. What did you guys think about the scene of Kirk kind of being the one to think of the idea with the tricorder and all?
I think Shatner would have liked it.
it's strange. Like, instead of, I like in the, well, I mean, this goes without saying, I like in the episode, the actual episode, better than this, where they've scanned the original timeline and they're trying to find the divergent point. And, you know, and the dramatic point is it breaks before it can tell him, and you know, he has to fix it. In this one, he's just like, hey, tricorder, figure out what might be important. You know, just scan around, you know, within like a 10-block radius and tell us what might be important around here. And the tricorder's like, okay.
Yeah, it seemed a little bit too pat kind of thing.
Well, and then it tells them that there's 616,590 focal points. And then that's when Kirk's like, well, just make that a 10-kilometer radius from where we are. You know, and then it tells them, and then it breaks. And it tells them that it's damaged, and it can only give you partial data. And then it starts to repeat the phrase from the Guardians, which is, you know, blue, the burning sun, the key, and then it's just gone, kind of like the original episode. And so I think that, I don't know if it's just an interesting difference here. And it's interesting to see how they, you know, just twist it for the episode to kind of really give it what we know of and make it feel, I guess, a little bit more Star Trek. So,
well, that was something in the original episode that just always kind of bugged me a little bit, was that they couldn't even access the information on the tricorder, period, without the ship's computer. Mm-hmm. And that always just kind of bugged me, like, this unit isn't...
Yeah, it's in the cloud.
Right.
Yeah.
It's all in the cloud is what it is.
Yeah, but, like, you can't... There's no way to view any of the information on there unless you hook it up to a...
You've got
to
remember...
Damn it, this planet doesn't have Wi-Fi!
You got to remember, in the 60s, they can't imagine having a handheld device that would have information on it.
No, I get that for sure. But, you know, being a child of the 80s, I was kind of like, what?
I say, holding my iPad, looking at Kirk and Spock holding
exactly.
The tricorder on it.
They figure out, obviously, that the tricorder, it needs to be fixed, and Kirk realizes this is going to take having an actual job that's going to pay him money. And the great thing is, again, this guy comes in and says, I know a place where Spock can work.
Isn't it the same guy? Yeah. It's the same guy.
Yeah, it's the same guy.
He's just like, jobs, eh? I understand that it's really hard for people who've lived here their entire lives to get a job, but... You weird people who barely speak our language because you're 500 years from the future. You know, yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah. I really like the way that you look. You look like a Chinaman. At least that's what I think you look like.
And this is the point where it cuts back to Rand on the ship. Like,
yeah. They're coming in. No, stop them.
Meanwhile, at that very moment, but not actually.
500 years in the future, but also in the past.
Oh, gosh. Well, and then we get this whole scene with Spock, and he's washing dishes. He's doing his job. It's payday, and the guy basically does the math, you know, for what he's going to get paid, and is going to cheat him out of money. And Spock grabs his hand and basically forces him to give him the money he's owed.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That bugged me a little bit.
It's pointless. It's pointless.
It is. It's kind of a pointless scene, except for the fact that as he walks out of the job, he's the one who discovers Edith Keeler.
Yes, it's true. So yeah, we get the same surprised look, but it's like, okay, so the poem is blue. It will be blue as the sky of the old earth, and that's the cloak that Edith is wearing, and then she's peeking her, you know, love and peace stuff. So, you know, and clear as truth is the next part of it, and the sun will burn on it, and so she's got a sun clasp on her thing, and there is the key. Okay, all right, sure. So she's the focal point. That's great, Guardians. No. Her last name's Keeler. And Spock actually points that out. No. Her last name's Keeler. She's got to be the focal point because the Guardians are really into puns. It's like, no.
Yeah.
Keeler. Get it? No, Spock. I don't need to get it. That's really dumb.
I don't know. Like, would the Guardians have been speaking English, for example, in order to make a pun?
They're really smart. Yeah. I mean, they've been there for thousands upon probably millions
and
of years.
And see, they,
you know,
knew
they have
her name.
A lot of
so
time.
Why
in their
not
hands.
Just tell them? If you're gonna spoil it like that, you might as well just go all the way.
Yeah, we just didn't want to give away the part of the story, you know. It's just boring when you do that. So we just figured it'd be more of an adventure if you had
right,
to go
exactly.
in and like figure it out.
Yeah, this is where that first draft that you mentioned, where they just actually spell it out. I mean, like in real life, that makes way more sense, even though it mm-hmm. kind of guts the story later. So, you know why they got rid of that, but that's what would happen.
And then this is such a strange thing, because Kirk and Spock are having this conversation about, you know, if she's the focal point, then we need to stay close to her and everything, and then they end up like peeping Toms on the roof, like watching her through their like the house, like. And of course, you know, as they're having this conversation, you know, Kirk's already falling in love because she's so beautiful. And I mean, you know, whatever.
Yeah, it was pretty creepy.
Oh, gosh.
It's really creepy.
And then we do find out.
Yeah.
Yeah. This was an interesting thing. So, you know, Spock can't eat human food, basically. He needs this Kiva juice and he needs some Yobash. Some Yobash and Kiva.
Okay.
Is he like from Star Wars? Like, this just sounds like something you would... those sound like aliens from Star Wars that you met in, you know, the Tatooine bar.
The twin bounty hunters, Yobash and Kiva.
Exactly. Oh, gosh. So they've talked about the fact that they need to get an apartment in her building. Spock basically, I guess, runs off to get some food. And then Kirk introduces himself by saying hello. And she says hello.
Yeah.
And then he says hello. And then she says
that's
hello.
That's actually, he's not kidding. This is how the conversation goes in Harlan mm-hmm. Ellison's, you know, award-winning script. Hi.
At least Kirk says, I guess that was a pretty lame way to meet you. And she says, on the contrary, it worked marvelously. I'm Sister Edith Keeler. Yeah. So he talks about how he just moved in, and she tells him he's quite handsome.
She places his accent,
lovely.
Which is weird.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, apparently sounds just like he's from Iowa. You know, those
Iowans. Iowa, 500 years in the future. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Thick accent. Well, I mean, if Scotty is supposed to sound like he's from Scotland and they still have the accent, you know, maybe...
Yeah, but...
Kirk still
this,
sounds
this
like
is an interesting
from
thing
Iowa.
From one of the earlier drafts, too, is that... Harlan realized that he's sending these characters back 400 or 500 years in the past because they hadn't really established the exact year. So he's going off of like 500. At one of the earlier drafts, they talk about having to adjust their universal translator to translate 1930s English. Because think about it. Like like if we went to King James days. And we're trying to have a conversation with King James. And he's like, you know, Versooth, see, verily, thou doest this. And you're like, okay.
Right on, buddy.
Somebody had a little bit too much the sauce this early in the morning.
And then you're killed as a witch.
Right. So so this whole accent thing is really funny because it's still Harlan. You know, he dropped the whole needing the universal translator thing, but he's still just like, oh, the accent will be, you'll be able to place it, even though, you know, we'll have a united Earth government and, you know, Iowa probably doesn't exist. Thankfully, Kirk knows what Iowa is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that is an, that is one of those questions that somebody I would love to see, like, answered of how, obviously, one world government on Earth kind of works, because there are still distinct, I mean, Alaska. Even we know from Enterprise, you know, the British Empire still has a navy that, you know, Malcolm's father was in, and everybody in his family has been in. Mm-hmm. So for him not to be in it was a kind of a disgrace for him and his family. So apparently America, the USA, still exists, and there are still the states and all that. How that all works, who knows? But it's an interesting concept to think that we still have distinct countries, except that we're all one at the same time. I who knows? Kumbaya is probably sung a lot. And this issue ends with Kirk and Edith basically walking out the door, and Spock standing behind like a serial killer, looking on. And we jump to issue 4, which leads us to the already happy couple having some dinner, which is very sweet. In fact, Kirk walks through the door, and Edith knows that it's him, and, you know, it's open, Jim. So apparently they've been spending a lot of quality time together.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to keep an eye on her, Jim. Okay. You want me to sleep with her? No. I want you to keep an eye on her. You want me to move in with her? No, I just want you to keep an eye on her. Like how we were on the roof? You want me to fall in love with her? No.
They have this, I guess, cutesy conversation. Kirk talks about how his feet hurt because these shoes aren't very comfortable that he bought, these cheap shoes and all of that. And then... this was a very interesting part of this issue, and honestly, I thought, too, artistically, probably one of the best things in the comic, the way that they light this whole conversation between Kirk and Spock. Spock is challenging him, you know, you're getting too close to this woman, and Kirk's trying to say, no, I'm not, you know, he's trying to do his part, he's trying to do the right thing and not fall in love with her, and yet at the same time, he can't help it. And what did you guys kind of think about this back and forth conversation? Because it's another one of those places where Spock opens up in a way that we don't necessarily see Vulcans do, and that human side really comes, you know, to show in a way we just, you know, we wouldn't normally see with Spock until, say, Star Trek VI.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I did really love this section. Especially, like, the artwork, first of all, the styling of it, I thought was really perfect to set the mood and that kind of thing. And the conversation, yeah, I thought it was really great, personally.
What did you end up thinking, Drew? Because this is probably the most personal of the conversations that they end up having between them, and it kind of caps that idea of what we think of as the Kirk-Spock relationship in some ways.
Yeah, it's a good conversation. It's definitely the best scene in the whole script / comic. I mean, just like the scene of, I mean, this is the equivalent of the, you know, Edith Keeler must die scene, and I don't think that you can. I mean, you could probably fail at writing that scene, but I don't think that either of the interpretations of that scene fails. They both break your heart. But it just so happens that in the comic, he already knows that she's the focal point. He just doesn't know why, because he wasn't listening to the part where it said that Beckworth is going to save something that needs to die. Because he wasn't listening to that part, because why would he listen to these ancient gods?
It can't possibly be important.
Right. No. These riddles. Riddles. blah, 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 riddles. I'm sure Kirk doesn't care about riddles.
Yada, yada, yada. Can I fall in love with someone?
Yeah, exactly. Well, this was really interesting too, because they changed something again that was very well done, I thought. You know, they're walking up the stairs together and she falls and Kirk doesn't reach out to save her.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's a really powerful scene for this comic, because Kirk is really willing. I mean, he's falling in love with the person, but he's also really willing to, you know, let her die.
Now.
Exactly. Now that he's in love with her, and she's in love with him. But I thought that was really cool, because she falls down the stairs and she ends up being okay. Even though the way that she looks in the comic looks like a dead person.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody normal that falls like that and just pops up and is like, no, I'm all right, Jim. Yeah. No, it didn't hurt at all. it's a mere flesh wound. I'll be fine in a minute. So it turns out that they end up seeing Beckwith appear. No,
they've managed to figure out exactly when and where he's going to show up.
Yeah.
And you know what they do? Immediately lose him. Where are their phasers? Shoot him. Stun him.
No. Come on. That's way too easy. Because Kirk needs to go have his moment with Edith to tell her to stay indoors, don't come out. They profess their love for each other. It's really, really nice. Kirk and Spock basically go on the prowl. They're going to go find Beckwith at this point. And Kirk gets the stashed phaser. This is where they pull it. They've actually stashed the phaser away. And they go chasing Beckwith.
No, what's interesting is that Spock has the phaser, and Kirk says you can't use that on Beckwith. We have to bring him back alive. But then Kirk realizes that Spock is going to shoot Edith.
Yeah, I thought that was incredibly dark. I read that, I was super like, oh dark. My
incredibly
God.
Stupid. Yeah, it doesn't. It just
she
doesn't
has to die.
Go
I might as well disintegrate her. I'm like, wait, no, Spock. That's not how things work.
Well, and then, you know, so Spock is on his way to kill her, and he's attacked by Beckwith.
Who takes his phaser?
Of course.
Yeah, exactly. Who takes his phaser, and then to be continued. So we need to get one more issue. we get to get issue 5. It starts with, obviously, they haven't caught Beckwith. Edith hasn't died yet. And Kirk basically is just kind of bribing this veteran.
Trooper. Harlan Ellison's favorite character that he's ever written.
Yep. And he's fought basically at one of the battles in World War I. He's lost his legs. He's selling apples on the side of the street. And Kirk asks him to basically tell him if he's seen anybody wearing, you know, the Starfleet uniform. And if he does, to let him or Spock know. So they've got their own informant. And then we have our last final tear-jerking moment with Edith and Kirk.
Mm.
And she talks about how she's losing her faith in the world and humanity.
And then she refers to Spock as the Chinese fellow, which we haven't really touched on, but man, there's a lot of racial slurs against Chinese people in this comic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like Harlan Ellison doesn't like Chinese people, and I apologize to all those of Chinese
descent.
This
is kind of the way it was back then. So, I mean, he's just being...
Yeah, that is true.
He's not whitewashing the past.
Right, yeah. That all gets boiled down to the rice picker scene.
Yeah, and the bad part is that Spock interrupts them, because apparently Trooper has informed Spock where Beckwith is. And they go to find Beckwith, and turns out he's on a rooftop and goes to shoot Kirk with the phaser that he's stolen, and Trooper gets in the way and saves Kirk's life, which I thought that this was actually a really nice scene. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the whole, because the whole conversation that Kirk and Spock are going to have later, I think, is actually really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
A very, very powerful conversation, and probably, I'll just give it away, it is the redeeming conversation and ending, I think, that makes this a great story. And in you could have just tweaked this a little bit to make it more Star Trek-y, and this could have been the episode. Maybe without the drug part at the beginning. Maybe, you know, rework that a little bit too, but or something. But or just make it an informant or a spy or something who's been on the Enterprise. That would have been okay. But anyway, I think that's really great. And so for that, I love this scene. You know, just Spock being like, why? Why did he do that for you? And Kirk said, you know, because I gave him $2. It's just incredible the emotion they're able to play in the comic here. I think it's really great. Mm-hmm. So
absolutely.
Well, this is where the end comes. Okay, at least for Edith. What did you guys think about the just kind of the way that this ends up playing out?
I don't like it. Now I seem to remember in the script more of Spock having to hold Kirk back, which it isn't really represented on here. I don't remember if that was an earlier draft or not, but there was at some point where Kirk was going to go save her from being hit by the truck, and that Spock had to hold him back instead of holding back the person who was going to do it originally, which is what Spock does, is he grabs Beckwith and stops him from trying to save Edith. Because Beckwith is trying to save Edith, because that's what you do when you've got, you know, you don't let a poor old, even though you just murdered a veteran, you don't want to let, you know, a nice looking lady get hit by a truck. And I know that this is the crux of the story, but I just don't, the way that it works in the episode is so much, I guess, cleaner, but it's just better. That it's somebody we know, and that it's somebody we know wants to save it. Not this murdering drug dealer guy.
That's kind of the key difference between the two, I think, is introducing McCoy, someone we know and love. That said, I did really like this ending as well. Not as much, but I did think it was very interesting that Beckwith, this person we've seen do horrible things, still kind of had enough quote-unquote humanity in him to attempt to save someone being hit by a vehicle. I thought that was kind of interesting, and I don't know, I kind of like to explore that a little bit more, but I'm not sure what else to say.
And that's that's the cool thing. So they, we'll talk through this part a little bit quickly. They end back on the planet because everything is reset, and Beckwith ends up running back into the vortex thinking he can escape. And it ends up that the Guardians tell him that his forever will be in the heart of an exploding sun, a nova that he has named his own doom. And it is a wretched looking scene of horror and anguish. It makes me think of the idea of what I feel like hell looks like for people that just continues to go on forever and ever. And so really well represented here. And this is where I think I'd like to go and just kind of wrap up our discussion of the comic series. It is a fantastic conversation.
Yeah.
Kirk and Spock have, because Spock can't understand. He says, you could not stop Beckwith. I understand that. But Beckwith, an immoral, evil, a killer, selfish, and capable of anything. Why? And Kirk says, why did he risk his life to save her or his own? And he says, yes. And then Kirk says, we look at our race and this parade of men and women and the unbelievable harm and cruelty they do, and we sigh and say, perhaps our time is past. Let the sharks and the cockroaches take over. And then he says something I think is just really profound. He says, and without knowing why or even thinking of it, the worst among us does the great thing, the noble deed, that spark of impossible human godliness. And we say, perhaps the human race is entitled to a little more sufferance. Let them keep trying to reach the dream. And Spock says, evil can come from good and good from evil, which is such a biblical, I mean, this just drips with Judeo-Christian biblical values of that there's an absolute depravity of humanity, And then at the same time, there's also something we see in ourselves, as Kirk says, a spark of impossible human godliness. Mm-hmm. And how these two things war with each other. And this is what I thought just made this so powerful. And even though I don't like this as much as I like the original episode, I like this conversation and this ending 20 billion times more, because the weight of the metaphysical conversation that Spock and Kirk are having, basically about the problem of evil, is incredible.
Mm-hmm. I agree on that note a great deal. I kind of spent probably when I first read this about 20 minutes just kind of going back over these last couple of pages again and again, because I don't know, something really spoke to me in it. I thought it was amazing.
Yeah, like I said before, and I said that I would say again, this is a good story. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's worth reading, it's worth discussing, it's worth talking about and thinking about. It's just, it's a good Twilight Zone. It's a good, it's a good, you know, just one-off kind of story. It doesn't need to be Kirk and Spock to make these points,
right?
Which is the thing, and that Harlan's big problem is like, oh, they changed everything about it, but they made it Star Trek. They made it. They gave us the character beats that this did, which, you know, because DC knows the characters. That's why she changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it is a shame to lose that kind of conversation, but you also gain the simplicity of the ending of the episode, which is, you know, the moral of the story. It's obvious. The moral of the story of the episode, and they're not going to speak it to you. They're not going to give you a big speech about it. They're just going to say, let's get the hell out of here and just cut to the credits.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, let's talk a little bit about that, between the differences and the things that, you know, we may have liked or didn't like. I think looking back now and kind of seeing where this original, his final draft came, and then where DC took it, is a really great amalgamation. I just wish that she had been able to keep this conversation, and by changing it to have McCoy be the person, you did lose a big thrust of the story. And I feel like you could have, you know, we had done in Star Trek, you know, you could have had this person, you know, they didn't have to be a drug dealer or anything. But, you know, maybe they're a spy and they're trying to get away, and they pick up a hypo and they don't know what's in it, and it causes, you know, that kind of thing. Basically, something like that, just so that you could get still to this end conversation, which I think is, it's such a Star Trek-y conversation, and it's so rife with amazing metaphorical ideas in a strange, very strange mixture of as a lot of especially early Star Trek is, and then Deep Space Nine is, atheism and Judeo-Christian values kind of ramming against each other and pushing on each other, trying to, you know, find some kind of semblance of understanding between the two, and how do we move forward. That's what I really love about this. And so, yeah, this isn't better than the original story that we see on screen. It's not worse. It is just different. And I think it's so worth going in and taking a look at.
And the best part about reading it in the comics is you don't have, you're not buying something where a third of it is Harlan Ellison complaining about his readers of that particular book, because that's the entire first third of that screenplay is an essay that he wrote that's just, you know, then freaking Gene Roddenberry, oh, you think he's so perfect, but he's not. He's a liar and a cheat, and he cheated me out of my story, and it's it's incensing.
Wow.
Well, quickly, what did you guys think? Because it's a big part of this story. artwork? Thumbs up, thumbs down. Did it work for you? Does it not work, Drew?
I've seen this artwork before in the Doctor Who Next Generation crossover thing, and I don't like it. I like my comics to, yes, look like the characters, sure, but I don't like it when they look exactly like the character. Especially when, you know, like Dan and I were saying, we recognize a lot of these screenshots. And so it's just like, oh, well, you know, you might as well do what that one guy did. I don't know, did that come out yet? The one with the, he did the photo novels again? But like used all the screenshots and stuff.
John Byrne's photo. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yep. You might as well do that. I mean, the style I like if it was a poster on my wall, I'd really like it. But as a sequential story, I don't care for it.
The shots of the characters that were taken from the episodes, I do have to admit that kind of brought me out of the story a couple times. To me, the parts that really stand out are the original parts, like for example when the first crew member is basically getting high on the bridge, and just that progression of his face I think is incredible. We talked a little bit about the Beckwith at the end in the heart of the Nova. That was one page I stared at that for like a good few minutes, just kind of picking out little details. It was incredible. I love those sequences. That conversation between Kirk and Spock, like we'd said, was just outstanding. A couple times, I agree with you here and there, the character likenesses, the basically just copied from screen captures and that kind of thing, it was a little bit, oh yeah, I know what episode that's from. But overall, I love the artwork in this.
I'm more on the side of really loving the artwork, especially the scenes... like the city we talked about, you know, I thought like that worked so well. And I personally, unlike you, Drew, I love that artwork where they're able to capture the likeness of the character so well. But at the same time, it feels like art. Like this comic just felt like it felt like an Alec Ross comic to me, which I really enjoy Alec Ross's work. Especially on like Kingdom Come or those kind of things, or you know, he's done tons of covers or anything like that. So I like that. But this one, in some ways, like you said, Dan, there were some of those trippy moments, or any time when they were talking to the Guardians, it was really good. Mm-hmm. Or some of those establishing shots of you know, 1930s were fantastic. You know, so I really and just kind of liked that. In the end, the comic here. What would you guys rate it? Drew, what rating would you give to this five-part series?
Oh, goodness. Well, I don't even know how I would rate it. Like, I don't want to rate it in comparison to the actual episode.
Yeah, I would just say it's a standalone, you know, Star Trek story.
As a historical artifact, I've been wanting to refer to it as that. Because... I love the behind the scenes stuff, you know, these are the voyages, all that kind of stuff, and it's great to have that kind of historical thing comic booked. I'd love to see like the original version of the alternative factor in this kind of format, you know, just to see more what ifs like this. And so I guess as a concept and as a story, I'm gonna give it a 7 out of 10. Do we do silly? Do we do silly numbers here?
No, I think that's. I think it's.
No, I mean,
it's,
do we do like definitely like one 7 out of 10? You know, time traveling monkeys or anything like that.
We do.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, that's it. Time traveling monkeys. I don't know where they came from, but they're here now.
I love it.
Oh man, again, it's tough because you want to bring in the original episode, the classic episode that you grew up with. But if I were to take it on its own, by itself, irrespective of anything else, I would have to give it probably 8 out of 10 jewels of sound.
Ooh, excellent.
They were jewels, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Thinking through this, I think that it's definitely, like you said, Drew, earlier, it's worth the read. You should pick this up, you know, especially as a Star Trek fan and just kind of... even if you're just somebody who's also just interested in how scripts work,
yes,
you know, and the changes that they go through, it's a very interesting thing to see how the rewrite process goes through, because, you know, you can read this and then you can go watch the original episode and see what DC did with that and how, you know, script writers work and how they rewrite things. You know, I'd love to actually see some of the original scripts from Star Trek II.
Mm-hmm.
Done like this, and then kind of see what Meyer had done to it, since he just took bits and pieces he liked from all of them, and in what, 12 days he created Star Trek II. You know, so that's what, those are the kind of things that I think are really interesting, and I would say, you know, this is probably for me 7.5 Janice Rand ass kickings. So, you know,
nice.
Just
good rating.
Yeah, so, well, Drew, it has just been fantastic to have you on the show. And tell everybody where they can find you on the interwebs and, of course, the network.
They can very easily just flip over to Standard Orbit. I don't know how you might flip in your podcast thing, but it's like another channel on your dial there. There, Mike Schindler and I talk about TOS. We do commentaries. We're in the middle of our creating our own canon, where we're throwing out episodes that we don't really think need to be there. Mike says, like, saying that brevity is the soul of wit. And so, you know, sometimes shorter is better. That's been a fun series we've been doing. We've also been kind of stepping on your territory. We've been talking about the JJ-verse comics and comparing them to the episode, and discussing the changes that it looks like the JJ-verse is making, and how that all led into Darkness, which is a lot helpful. We haven't gotten past Into Darkness. I don't know. I haven't even read those comics yet, so we haven't gotten into that yet. But you can also find me on Twitter at 005, DOUBLEOFIVE, and I also hang out at the Babel Conference, which you can get to at facebook.com/groups/TheBabelConference.
Well, that was a lot of fun talking about the Harlan Ellison City on the Edge of Forever comics with Drew.
Yeah, it really was. It was great to be able to get a chance to talk through that finally. You know, I, as I said, I hadn't touched it at all and was really interested to see what was actually going to happen and play out in these comics. I've never read the screenplay either. So I had a great time today, you know, discovering this. Mm-hmm. And regardless of whether I liked parts of the story, it was an enjoyable experience experiencing a Star Trek story in a different light.
Definitely. I really enjoyed reading it. I didn't read it all in one day like you did, but I did find myself reading an issue and then kind of immediately downloading the next one to check it out. And so, you know, in about three evenings, I went through all five issues, and I was impressed. Like you said, don't know about comparing it to the original. You don't really want to do that too much, but it was a really enjoyable experience, and I loved reading it.
Well, Dan, it's been great talking to you and of course, Drew, about City on the Edge of Forever, Harlan Ellison's original script in the comics, but it's not the only thing that we've been talking about on Trek FM here the past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Because it's actually legitimately trying to say something.
Yes, very Star Trek. It may be the most Star Trek of all Star Trek.
Yeah, it's definitely what I would point to as being, this is what science fiction is about.
Earl Grey.
Kovac will tell us to experience Bij sometimes, in which case we will draw the Bij card, Klingon word for pain. So,
is it our birthday?
It is. It's going to be a lot of fun.
To the journey!
That's the one thing we could take from Homecoming is, like, paragraph one, Chakotay and Seven break up. That's for real.
Yeah, they that shake happened. Hands and go, hey, it's been fun. It's been nice. Thanks for the picnic.
Eh, see ya.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Fair at this enough. Point, like, they could say, yeah, why not? Star Wars crossover. I would essentially say, fine. Both franchises are dead. Let's just sew them together and see what happens.
Melodic Treks.
one of the most well thought out alien races that you only see in one episode.
Yeah, and the music is it's menacing without being over menacing, if that makes sense.
Axanar, the official podcast.
I think Justin Lin is a fascinating choice to direct, because the Fast and the Furious movies, even though, yeah, they're action, adventure, road race movies, are really about a family.
The 602 Club.
That's really cool, though. I mean, I think that is a fantastic way to get to see just about any movie, is kind of being able to watch it through a kid's eyes.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we'll be talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're an Apple user, be sure to hit that subscribe button. It really helps us out greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the show when they search in iTunes. And so do star ratings and reviews. So if you give us one of those, let us know you did, especially if you're in another country, and we'll give you a shout out on the show. But if you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file and grab the RSS link as well. Another way that you can help keep all of our shows coming to each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and the milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. And these perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. Guys, we can't do this without you, and we really appreciate any support that you can give us, and we hope that you will join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you'd like to contact us, you can do so at trek.fm/contact. You can leave us a voicemail. You can go to the sidebar on the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. We're on Twitter at trekfm, Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and of course, we're all in the Babel Conference. That's our listeners-only group there on the Babel Conference. Just search B-A-B-E-L in the search field on Facebook, or make it easier on yourself. Go to Trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. We'd like to thank our associate producers here on the show, Will Wynn, who's on Twitter at Will_Wynn, and of course in the Babel Conference. He's also the associate producer on The Orb and Earl Grey, and is Trek.fm's content coordinator. If you have any ideas for future shows or content, just shoot him off an email at will.win@trek.fm, or, of course, just send him a tweet. And we'd also like to thank Lisa Stevens for her support of the network and being an associate producer on Literary Treks as well. You can find her on Twitter at flip18. And before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor, who helps bring Literary Trek and all of our shows to you each week. And our sponsor, of course, is Audible.com, the perfect sponsor for Literary Treks. Audible is a great way to read all of those books, and especially all those back catalog Star Trek books that you never thought you'd have time for. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice with a 30-day trial just to see how great Audible is. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank them for their support of Literary Treks and the network. So, Dan, before we go, of course, where can everybody find you online?
Well, Matthew, you can find me on Facebook. I'm on facebook.com/treklitreviews. I'm on Twitter at treklitreviews. My website, where I review Star Trek novels, both new and old, is just www.treklit.com. And my reviews of newer novels are carried on TrekCore.com as well. And Matthew, when you're not stalking Edith Keeler from the rooftops of Depression-era New York, where can we find you?
Well, goodness, that's a full-time job these days. but you can find me, of course, on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me doing the 602 Club, talking about all things geeky all the time. We just choose a new geek topic every week and go at it. So join us there. You can also find me doing The Orb with Christopher Jones, where we talk about Deep Space Nine all the time. And then the last place is on my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, live long and read on.
What do you call that, light reading?
To each his own, number one.
Yuman Rand is definitely the best thing about this whole thing.
Yeah, she looks great. Yeah, that might be the teaser at the, I mean the stinger at the end, right there.
That'll be the one thing that we can all agree on. But yeah, Yuman Rand, she looked great.
There we go.